All right, and we are live May 30, 2022, coming at you from Belgrade, Serbia. Yep. We got a different take today. We're going to be looking at these developments in the front and how funny they are to see the kind of like the news cycle. And what's going on, it's like an alternate reality, yeah? Anyway, I'm Joaquin Flores, a geopolitical analyst. We're going to be digging in today into reviewing some of the mainstream media cope, a lot of cope out there, cope on this conflict. And it what inspired it was, you know, we have these big developments right now, Severodonetsk. This is the easternmost... you know, town, city, what have you, not yet under Russian control. It had been the fact of its control by the Ukrainian forces, you know, being a part of Ukraine and all, I mean, right, had been touted previously in media as, you know, evidence of, you know, what have you. So now that... they have basically lost Severodonetsk. They're now reporting that it is in jeopardy. This is how this is kind of like a funny kind of refraction, like echo thing. The event basically already occurred yesterday and overnight. And today, you know, there'll be more official word. The problem is that securing that town, if you pull up your map, you'll see that it's actually a conjoined town. It's got, let's do it now. I mean, for those of you who are intimately, you know, following the blow by blow, already know exactly what I'm saying. You're already ahead. You've already a few pages ahead of me on that. But, you know, but look at, we're looking at Severodonetsk. Yeah. So if you, to orient yourself, if you find Lugansk, it's just over to the left and up, right? It's northwest of Lugansk, and it's directly east of the Sloviansk-Kramatorsk juncture there. Anyway, the thing with Severodonetsk is that it has this other kind of city settlement on the other side of the river, of the Seversky Donetsk River, which means north river. Sever just means north, which is interesting because it makes you think about, like, in Indo-European language, like the word severe. You think about the north and like severe conditions, maybe like a harsh winter or something like that. Severe, Severo, I don't know. I always look for those. You find that they're related often. It's not that abstract. But looking at the Severodonetsk, you can see that there's this other settlement that's almost the same size. I mean, in terms of, you know, square kilometers, but it's a probably different population. And it's basically just separated by this little, it has a bridge and that connects the two. And they're like, you know, realistically, they're right next to each other. You know, when, as you're standing, it would be like 2-3 kilometers or like a mile and a half away. It's really the same. It's an extension of the same thing. And so the question is, would you consider it secure, right, Severodonetsk, if, because we heard that yesterday, the rest of the main force that wasn't obliterated, the Ukrainian force, made way over the river to Lysychansk. That's the Lysychansk is the place that we're, you know, that's connected to Severodonetsk. So they kind of just moved. Now, there had been like all this chatter about big Ukrainian counteroffensives, and then these kind of just disappear, right? You'll find that these just disappear from the you know, from the news cycle, right? And they don't really explain themselves. They don't really say, oh, you know, I guess we heard this wrong. And there's a, basically, we point that out to show that in the coverage of this, and this may be obvious to some of you, all of you, I hope, but let's say it anyway, that when you look at the spread of this thing, that in the reporting on it, they are consistently withholding back developments that run contrary to their own, you know, media. And then finally, they have to come up with some cope, which is to explain away that, yes, this has happened, but that, no, you know, it doesn't mean anything bad, although it does mean something bad. If you don't send, if you don't participate, wear your, you know, Ukrainian flag badge and call your congressman to free up another $30 billion for Ukraine. I mean, in that sense, they always include that this is important. We have to not, you know, it's basically they're doing a lot of advertising in journalism these days for political parties. So CNN has it on its front page. It's talking, it's the you know, big thing there is that Ukraine military reports more cross-border shelling. I don't know what that means. You know, it's cross-border, doesn't make a lot of sense. But we're talking obviously about Severodonetsk. And there was a funny incident that occurred along the way where they, I guess Zelensky ran to the front and had a on Sunday had like an impromptu visit to troops at the front line, and he says, "I want to thank each of you for your service. You risk your life, yeah, no shit, for all of us in our state. Thank you for defending Ukraine's independence. Take care of yourself." He said, "That's a kind of anticlimactic way to fit," but it's actually so honest. Isn't it refreshingly honest? Just go take care of yourself, you know, because it ain't going to be us, by the way. It ain't going to be us taking care of you. You know, a lot of cope out there. And so how did we end up in this? Such a mess for these people. You can see it too. You can see it. Where they have landed, the Washington Post says, quote, "Severodonetsk devastated as Moscow makes East, quote unquote, absolute priority." Okay, so the truth is kind of starting to get out about Severodonetsk, right? The truth is starting to get out. And whenever they show, by the way, whenever they show all these images of these like cities and the towns and the streets in Ukraine, it looks so much like Yugoslavia, like Serbia. It's like copy. It's like cut paste. It's crazy. Like the trees and the architecture and the blocks and everything like that. It's pretty amazing. The layout. It's pretty amazing. Even the bricks, little stylings, you can totally see it was the same people involved, because it was. So yeah, we have the Washington Post say that the Russian troops' assault on Severodonetsk, one of the last Ukrainian-held cities in the country's eastern Lugansk region, continued Sunday, as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said 90% of the city's buildings and all of its critical infrastructure had been destroyed. Does that remind you of the Mariupol line? That they destroyed it, you know. So this is like, how do you cope with they fucked it up, you know what I mean? How do you cope with they went in there and, right, and that they have it? So we have the photo of the, we shared something earlier. Big thing with the photo. It's kind of staged photo, but you can see that it's the city administration, the Severodonetsk. You can see it. He's holding the plaque The guy who's not holding an instrument or a flag, he's holding the plaque. We shared it. Just, you have to scroll up on the main page, just a couple of posts back. Yeah, you'll see it. And on the website, like, or, you know, the internet, whatever, the Yandex, like the Russian Google, on Yandex, you put in the business, like, hours and stuff, it comes up that it's closed today. And you can see from the first picture, yeah, it's probably closed today. I don't know if it's obvious to people everywhere that the city administration is like the city government building, and they now control, that means they have the center of the city. So that's like the capture the flag, yeah. That's what's so significant about that. Remember the beginning of the conflict and all the changes of the flags and everything? Got to be careful about that stuff. Now, because this is Severodonetsk, it's obviously part of Lugansk, and there's no question about, you know, what might happen. In the Kherson region, Russia was being real careful with the international law kind of thing about, you know, seizing territory and all those things. And, okay, I mean, it's a pretty easy case against Russia, like, that they, like, recognize these semi, you know, paramilitary civilian governments that they recognize to have authority in the areas subsequent to, you know, denazification. And then they have these pro-Russian little republics pop up wherever the Russian army exists. Now, is there a way to talk about this in a less cynical way? Well, actually, you know, I was thinking about this, and the truth is that, you know, if you have, like in Kherson, 60, I think 80% of people of Kherson, 70 or 80% of people of Kherson speak Russian at home, consider Russian their first language, and that's not the same thing as a different demographic, probably included in that larger statistic, but there's a smaller demographic in there that actually consider themselves to be Russian. Okay, there are people who consider themselves to be Russian and Ukrainian, and there's just so many things. Like, are you, you know, are you New Yorker or are you American, you know? Are you a Floridian or are you an American? There's kind of this thinking. I know it's weird, but some of this, you know, we talked about in Russia, and you run into millions of Ukrainian names, and you can traipse about Ukraine and run into millions of Russian names. These are like, you know, there's a place on the map called Ukraine, and there's a place on the map called Russia, but in truth, people live all over the place, right? Yeah, there's a stronger correlation, you know, to like identity and the place on the map, but not as tight as people might otherwise have thought. And then we saw this conflict, right? But my thinking is that, you know, when you have denazification and you have a population, if you grew up speaking a language and that's your primary language, you probably speak, you know, one of the several pidgins called Ukrainian, as opposed to the Ukrainian language, the attempt to build a prestige dialect out of some combination of some Kievan accent combined with the, you know, Western Ukrainian, I call it the language Hitlerian. But you have, no, it's basically Polish spoken with a Russian accent. You have some interintelligibility with these refugees, migrants, whatever. We're going to talk about those people in a little bit, by the way. Anyhow, so you have this cope, and the reality is setting in, okay? It's setting in. Zelensky at the front, they need this PR. They need the headlines. The event, it's setting up for today, is a special European Council summit today, and then Tuesday, tomorrow, is going to be day two of that, and it's basically about how diplomats, the European diplomats, failed to reach an agreement on phasing out Russian oil. So Zelensky is going to personally, virtually, so he's going to show up on that screen again and insult everybody and then get into his begmanding posture. You know, we're saving Europe. You need to do your part. And we're very thankful. At the same time, we're resentful of you all. So hurry up. You know, stop being mean and thank you. I don't know what, you know, it's such a mixed message. New York Times. Oh, yeah. So Washington Post is going to do that. All right. And they are. This is their version of the reality that Severodonetsk is done. It's done. New York Times. Interestingly, New York Times. You know that their main web page actually still looks like an old newspaper in the layout. So you have above the fold and below the fold. So they don't, technically, I guess, if your browser is big enough, you can say that it's above the fold, that they mention Russia. But the big thing is the Texas, you know, the thing in Uvalde with the mass shooting event. People are saying it was like a stage thing or a false flag or something like this, or a mind control subject or something, or nothing happened. There's all kinds of theories. I haven't looked into it. Those things are always really suspicious to me, those types of events. And then they always come with like more gun control talk, right? So, yeah, you have, why do we mention that? Because it's coming out of the view. It's coming out of, there's a, reality is setting in, and we said this would happen, and we talked at length about the information war, and we talk about narratives and narrative drift and narrative co-aligning, narrative capture, yeah, narrative deviation, hijacking narratives, right? So you can see that there has been a, because there's been incoherent, you know, reportage, or we should say messaging from Western MSM. On the one hand, Russia is losing, or they could lose, or, you know, and that sort of keeps changing. Well, they could win, but at what great cost? And Putin will, you know, come down from power because the costs of winning are too high. You know, like, well, he was going to lose, now he's going to win, but now it's, you know, whatever, they're going to keep moving the goalpost. But it's setting in, the reality is setting in of actually what's been happening, yeah? And actually what's been happening is a methodical war of maneuver followed by a phase of attrition. Now we are in the phase of, we're moving from attrition. There's, I mean, all of these things are going to keep, you know, rinse, you know, reuse. I mean, it's going to keep happening in this cycle, you know, wash, rinse. But we're seeing that now in these pockets, in the east of the country. When you think about the conflict, there's really three or four fronts right now. But we're obviously focused on like two of those are the most interesting, even though down in the southwest, Nikolaev, I think when that pops off, it's going to be, I mean, there's always, there's never not a time when fighting is not happening, by the way. It's just these big pushes or these big, you know, then the media focus and there's some objective, like we're going to take this town or something like that. That hasn't been happening on the Kherson front with Mykolaiv. Okay, so there hasn't been a lot of focus on that yet, but there will be soon, I suspect. And with Kharkov, again, fake news that Russian forces were pushed into Russia, blah, 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 that didn't materialize, there's no evidence of it. Russians did actually admit part of that, actually, but that was just their maneuver. It's kind of a cool game that they can maneuver out of countries. They get to like warp around. They get to use like Belarus and Russia to like warp from place to place, like a whack-a-mole. Yeah. And Ukraine is like trying to play catch up and mobilize. Now there have been some positive effects of the efforts to resupply Ukraine with oil, lubricants, and fuel. Those are getting in, but in a very spotty way. They're still at reduced. It's a distribution crisis throughout the country, so it's not the same everywhere. But we showed some evidence the other day, 2 days ago, from Odessa, showing lines in the, I think outside of Odessa City, in the Odessa region, there were lines. And the max, I think, there was like a ration max that you could take. Anyway, so you can see how those things are falling apart. But looking at the tone, right, there's been this realization. And now the New York Times is calling this summit, right, that's happening today and tomorrow, subsequent to Zelensky visiting the front. By the way, like, we're almost going to hit 100 days of the conflict, like tomorrow or the next day, something like that. I think we're on day 98 or something like that. Anyway, we're getting there. We're getting there. But the New York Times, they believe that they believe that European leaders have an obligation to I know what can you do, but I don't think, you know, the nice thing about this reality that we live in is that there are very few people that are personally invested on the European side. So all these bureaucrats and decision makers, they're not passionate about hating Russia, they're not passionate about loving Russia, they're not passionate about many things. Typically, in their role in these bureaucracies, you know, of course, there are people trying to make headway who want to stand out, but a lot of people are pretty either realistic / cynical about potential to maneuver vertically inside of an organization, right? Like you're going to be on the leading edge of your little bureaucracy in some government, whatever department, on leading anti-Russia stuff, you see? So just to understand, now many people in government may in other spheres of life be more individually responsible and have skin in game, and they might be great at what they do. But in their role in European government, especially at the level of the EU in Brussels, these Eurocrats and even the Euroskeptics in the European Parliament, they're just going through the motions. And for them it's just the strategy of their maneuver in their career, but they're not on a mission. These aren't warriors. These are not like zealots or Jesuits, you see. They're not, whatever the answer is in the end, they individually feel that they will be fine. Like whatever comes of this mess, they feel individually, relative to everyone else and relative to their own position, they'll be okay. If they really thought that there was a crisis that threatened their own way of life, you would see a very different tone, yeah? You would see a very different dynamic unfolding. And new people would be like, they'd sound different. They would even sound credible. Because when people speak from their real interests and not like these canned, planned statements that reflect the committee on the council of the delegation, et cetera, this is, you know, building an anti-Russia policy by committee, right? This has all been a holographic war. Militarily, of course, Russia has the advantage. This is now being recognized everywhere. The way that these disinformation chains work is that it's just obviously there's not a conspiracy at the granular level. There's a lot of asshats running around who still have jobs writing because their job is to write crap, and they're still writing the old message on Russia Ukraine, which is that, oh, the Russian line of, you know, whatever is going to collapse at any minute. They're going to run out of supplies. Remember that? So yeah, that's a thing. And they still have a department. I mean, we're talking, we're being, what's the word, functionalist here. So yeah, through the, it's not a conspiracy. We're just talking about how this works out in reality. Yeah. So there's still functionally a department right in there of mainstream media that's still committed to bridging the gap between COPE and the old line. And how do we get from, you know, our old lie into a new lie, which takes account of undeniable new facts on the ground, right? Russia lost a lot when they took Mariupol, right? I mean, it cost them a lot, is right? That's the line. It's good, you know, they're going to have to, there's going to be reparations when they leave because there's going to be no peace. You know, Russia's not going to get out of any, you know, sanctions if it's going to continue to occupy Mariupol. Don't you want to get out of those sanctions, Russia? You got to let go of Mariupol. Right, like that's going to happen, you see? So, now, the whole story's coming apart. And every day it happens. Now, there's another big funny thing that happened. And you kind of have to ask yourself, well, how is this happening? Okay, so you have Zelensky to the front. Okay, CNN covers this. I like the way that they cover it because the COPE, you know, is built into the line. I love to analyze these things. You have just such a mess. I'm looking at the headlines here with you. This is just today. So we got into the Washington Post. Ukraine suffers on battlefield. There it is. Ukraine suffers on battlefield while pleading for U.S. arms. They're just raining down metal on us, said a soldier fresh from the front line where Russia is advancing. This is one of those articles that took four people to write. 900 words, four people. And you're wondering, what? How is that a job? Of course, in the WAPO style that the LA Times developed, they begin talking, instead of telling you who, what, where, when, why, and how, they start talking about, it was a sunny day overlooking the green pastures. This 34-year-old man stares straight ahead, his face swollen, his neck and back dripping with blood. Others lay silently under foil blankets. Some stumbled out the back doors and collapsed into... Fuck you! I want the... Like, if you want to write fiction, if you want to be a compelling writer, go write. Don't write for WAPO. People are here for not you, you know? Whoever you committee, O'Grady, Sohn, Birak, and Gulachka, writing by committee for their fiction contest. About 10 wounded soldiers arrived at this hospital in East Ukraine, less than an hour. You know, these kind of like first person, these kind of peeks into the story. Oh, very depressed looking Ukrainian soldier, injured, head wound, smoking a cigarette as he arrives in the hospital in eastern Ukraine. "70 people from my battalion were injured in the last week," said a soldier, an ambulance driver, just outside the hospital gates, who identified himself only as Vlad, 29. "I lost too many friends. It's hard for me. I don't know how many. It's getting worse every day." "The night before," he said, "the shelling was so loud he hardly got any sleep. It's artillery bombing down. All the wounded are coming from shrapnel." Yeah, that's typically, actually, that's pretty typical. "Most guys in the trenches haven't seen the enemy face to face." Yeah, most helmets are designed for, you know, shrapnel, deflected shrapnel. "Last week, one battalion of young soldiers on a road near Kramatorsk spent their days digging defensive trenches in a pocket not far from the front line. They were gearing up to provide additional support for the soldiers battling the Russians head-on, preparing for a worst-case scenario in which Russian forces continue or accelerate their current advance. That would be a potential turning point on the battlefield. Do you think? Is that the way they report that that is what's happening? Because that is what's happening, I think. And they float that this is happening, not by saying that it's happening, but that it could happen. But there it is. Everyone's tired, says Bodan, a 30-year-old soldier and officer in the battalion who spoke on the condition that only his first name be used in his precise position, not okay. But we are ready to stand and protect until the last man. In recent days, look at WAPO coming to terms. In recent days, Russian troops have captured the towns of Svitlodarsk and Lyman and have closed in on Severodonetsk, a large regional hub where Russian forces have entered a hotel on the city limits. Bear in mind that this was May 29th, reporting probably on information that was current as of like the 26th, 27th. Okay. If Russian troops manage to encircle and take the city, Moscow would occupy nearly all of Ukraine's easternmost Lugansk region, which makes up roughly half of Donbass. She was a showgirl, da 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 da, with yellow feathers in her hair, da 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 da. His name was Rico, he wore a diamond, da 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 da. Yep, it's Cope, man, at the Copacabana. Copacabana time. They're not liking this at all. So Bogdan continues, I mainly hope the boys don't get encircled in Severodonetsk. They need more guns. They need more weapons. I didn't read this first, I promise you. I just know the script. So I said, they're going to say, we're losing. Give us more weapons. Right, because you should always throw good money after bad. You should always, you should never consider when it's time to pull out and stop investing in a losing deal. You should always get involved in money pit scenarios. You should always throw good money after bad. That's my advice if you're NATO. Anyway, that seems to be their approach in Ukraine. He goes, or the article goes on, if he could send one message to Washington, he said, did you fucking ask him the question? If you could send one message, like, how do people, you see what I'm saying? Wouldn't it just be, we asked him, why wouldn't you just say you asked him so that things that people say don't sound like, you know, objection, leading, I've been watching that Amber Heard shit too, objection, leading, objection, speculation, you can't say for sure that more weapons for anti-aircraft would, in fact, help you close the sky. Speculation. Objection. The situation in the country's east marks a shift from the earlier stage of the war when staunch Ukrainian defense forced a broad Russian retreat. See how they have to incorporate? I told you they were going to do this. I said they have like a department. I know. It just functionally works this way, okay? They have to connect the new story to the old story. That's great. You ever watch like a series and or like a reboot or like a sequel and then you're like, did these writers not watch the original like show? Did they not watch the original movie? Like, don't you know that the Russians were defeated around Kiev and it forced them to withdraw? So whenever we explain how they're actually have an overabundance of force and that they're winning in the areas which, by the way, they said are their strategic objectives, but leave that alone. Just pretend that their objectives are to conquer every NATO country. Once you understand that there are several dozen NATO countries and that Russia has not conquered all of them and that 70% of Ukraine is still free, you can see that Russia is failing. If you evaluate their aim, if the Russian war aim, yeah, is to put the Russian flag on the Tour de Fel, or I don't know, they're going to like occupy 10 Downing Street. They're going to execute Boris Johnson. They haven't. They're not close there yet. They're still thousands of kilometers away. So we can say the Russians are losing from that perspective. Surely I jest. Surely you understand what I'm doing here. This is exactly how they approach the subject time and time again. But they continue. Listen to. So we got that. You got that. That send us weapons. Okay. Then the next line is, the situation in the country's east marks a shift from an earlier stage in the war where Ukrainian defenses were winning, basically, when they, I'm paraphrasing, quote, forced a broad Russian retreat in Kiev and other areas, comma, increasing confidence among Ukrainians and their Western backers about the prospects of an all-out victory over a poorly organized and poorly equipped Russian force. Having now regrouped, I swear I didn't read this first. I swear to Christ. I swear on my life. I just should have. I could have written it. I mean, they should hire me. Like, did you include the part about this? I would review these and say, you don't have, you actually don't have enough Zelensky quotes. Although they may know better. I don't know how Zelensky is, I don't know how he's trending. I don't know what his, how people associate his brand. I don't know where his brand is at right now. I don't know if people are tired. Are they saturated? Yeah. Have they seen too much? Does everyone know who he is now? But not too much. See, you want everyone to know who he is, but not really know who he is, right? Because it's like that. Kind of like me. Like, the more you learn about me, the less you like me. It's just like that. Having now regrouped, there it is. Russian troops are making incremental but steady progress in their campaign in the east and are regularly employing heavy flamethrowers and long-range artillery that Ukrainian forces lack, leaving Kiev on the back foot. So that's one writer. I always like say, okay, this is like by one person, and then someone's job it was to read that, right? And be like, yeah, but you're tilting a little bit too Ruski there. That's the problem. You see, that's the problem. So now I have to come in and I have to fix this article. So now you type, get it, start editing. Though Ukrainian resistance has made the fight a slog for Russian forces, Moscow is inching closer to encircling Ukraine's biggest strongholds in the Donbass region while fighting on territory contiguous to Russia with easier supply lines. It's the supply lines, so they have to keep the story consistent with supply lines. Like, how come Russians had a supply line problem, in areas that border fucking Russia, like in everywhere else, Belarus or Russia? Like, Kiev is, very close to... Kiev is closer to most of Belarus than it is to half of Ukraine. Yeah. Though Ukrainian resistance has made a fight a slog for Russian forces, Moscow is inching closer to encircling Severodonetsk. This is enough. This was a big enough development. Like, you guys probably much more than the average Joe, like, are in on kind of like, yeah, there's something happening here. You guys know when I say Nikolaev, you like your eyes orient, just to that province and that city directly, to the left of Crimea, to the left of Kherson. You already know this now, right? If you weren't like Ukraine geography experts, like none of us were, now you know. When we talk about that, you know what we're talking about. So you have a visual of this scenario, right? And you can see that they are setting this up, and we're going to get into that, to accept all of these things. They're already starting to change the media tone a little bit, which makes me think that the money may also dry up pretty soon. At least, look, don't be surprised with big announcements, but you have to actually look at how the money is apportioned and how it's allowed to be spent and what it really is for, okay? For example, and many people don't understand this, in the U.S., they can earmark certain money that was already in the budget in general for things relating to war and defense, which is like the plurality of all tax monies anyway. The plurality of your tax monies is for war, defense, etc. Now, when they announce money for Ukraine, sometimes, most of the time, it's actually not. It's not increasing the overall, you know, access to anything. It's just moving things around in their own budget and then declaring that this is for Ukraine. This is the for the category, you know, parentheses, Ukraine. That's there. That's for the accountants to deal with. And then they announce to the public, oh, $30 billion. Well, they don't have $30 billion in savings somewhere. They don't have $30 billion in anywhere, right? They're not going to the Federal Reserve to say, hey, you know, can you add, here's, you know, let me type you a three, and then can you add, you know, eight zeros or whatever, nine, whatever the fuck it is, on to behind this three? No. No, they're not doing that. It's just rearranging money that already is in the U.S. budget for defense. So there's no real new stuff going to, I mean, new dollars. There might be new equipment or new for them. Like me growing up, most of the things I had were new for me. For a week, Zelensky, you know, this is back to the to WAPO's COPE. WAPO's COPE, don't fall in love. His name was Rico. He wore a diamond. For weeks, Zelensky and other top Ukrainian officials have been asking the United States to provide multiple launch rocket systems, or MLRS, which would give Kiev the ability to strike targets from much farther away and a better chance at resisting the assault of the East. Now, we've heard if maybe that they would attack, you know, we don't know if it's sufficient, but if they could strike the bridge, Crimea bridge, something like that, you know. This was talked about, and they Arestovich said it's not going to happen. We don't have the ability, but maybe they would if they got something to do it, right? And they're going to, these are the kind of things that they will do, just to keep in mind. Expect those kinds of things because they take headlines. They it's a PR victory. You get to retell your story again. You get to include all, you get to connect all your talking, you know, chain them all up, you know. But let's review this work. Let's see if this person earned their paycheck, or this group of 50 people that collaborated to write 900 words. Whether the weaponry will get to Ukrainian forces in time, like I knock out 3,000 words a day. I don't know what the fuck these people do. Whether the weaponry will get to Ukrainian forces in time to stave off a significant defeat in the East is now unclear. Aha! So we can send it. I love how this comes, like, it just gets better, right? I swear. It just gets better. And you read through it, like, damn, oh shit, oh. Whether the weaponry will get to Ukrainian forces in time to stave off a significant defeat in the East is now unclear. You know what that, you know what now unclear means, right? That means it's totally fucking clear. The Russians already took Severodonetsk. So talking about getting weapons there in time right now is dumb. But because we're dumb, and because we hate the audience, by the way, they hate, they despise their own readers. Can you imagine that kind of abusive relationship? It's like my, like these, and the psychology and the people who work there, why the fuck they do it. It's like, my job is to misrepresent information to people, right? So now you have to think in ways that justify your own behavior, typically, this is a typical psychology, you have to justify your abuse by then reversing, by reversing the order of events. Well, these people are fucking dumbasses anyway. They don't know any better. So, and I have a mortgage to pay. It's my job to write these articles. And why should I write things that the editor is going to change? So just write what I know they want to hear. It's my job. There's no, this is not an abstract pursuit of truth. This is not an appreciation for knowledge or how to actually understand the world. It's a fucking job for propagandists who in turn have to get you to hate your own readers, because there's no way, there's a few other ways, but that's the main mechanism by which most people justify abusing people, is by believing they deserve it. So even though WAPO New York Times is out there misinforming, disinforming, dumbing down, framing things for their own readers in such a ass-backwards way that gives them a topsy-turvy, upside-down, backwards, you know, reverse unreality view of existence, and gaslights them. Did I say that 6 times yet? And then the consequence, the mass of non-playable characters who just imbibe, who just digest your lies, it dumbs them down, and then they earn your disrespect. You hate these dumb assholes who read your newspaper. Now you might hate even more people who make your life harder by calling out your lies or by writing things that are true and somehow arranging their lives in such a way that they're able to write what's true. Maybe not trying to live with 5 roommates in fucking Brooklyn, paying $4,000 a month to live in a closet, might be a good place to start doing journalism, like maybe out of your car from a parking lot, a place where you've got nothing to lose, just like starting a business. Go, you know, move out, live in a car, live out of your car, hit rock bottom. These people are not taking risks. You have, our little story develops. I love how these people are experts. I love how each, they talk to a 97-year-old woman. What we need right now are more javelins. What? How? Like, they just put the answers into their, no, so the way Russians do propaganda is super annoying. Don't get me wrong. They write in a different way. I mean, obviously it's I don't have Russian and it reads differently in Russian, but it's obviously, you can tell from TASS, RIA, Novosti, TASS, all of the kind of official-ish kind of mainstream news, or the ones that republish maybe, you know, foreign ministry statements and government statements, kind of like word for word, Izvestia, things like this. This is what they do, this kind of older Soviet style, where they say, they give the quote, someone said something, it's really what people said, like, it's actually just being stenographers for power. There's very little critical analysis that you catch and this is correct, right? There's very little editorializing, I should say, in the news in Russia. That's how it used to be in the U.S., but this is more of a Soviet model where they treat the statements of authorities as the truth. So you lose some of that kind of critical journalism and I'm not saying you need to editorialize in order to probe or to point out a contradiction or something like that, but it's just like that. They quote, paraphrase, person's title, and then the person's title again, and then the quote, which is almost the same as the paraphrase, and then like three lines or one line of background, this meeting, this summit, this event, this bill, whatever. Okay. American news has gone this very, very strange direction. We've talked about it before. I remember as a kid, like the LA Times began to become a fiction writing contest. The main column, left column, on the front page instead of starting out who, what, where, when, why, and then getting into the why and how. You have like these frustrated writers. It was a bright Sunday morning. Looking out his apartment window in East St. Louis, he saw a mother of four struggling to get out of a trash can. The area's been hit recently with hyperinflation. But Alex, 34, believes things will get better. That's American journalism. It's so stupid. Fake quotes, fake experts. You just put the words in that you want them to say. But yeah, they're suffering everywhere. Now, there's another part of this in the narrative shift that's happening. When you get over to the, what was it, NPR? Yeah, so National Public Radio. It's like the American version of BBC. Less budget, but very hawkish. Very, very, very right-wing in that typical sense in terms of, you say, like, you know, military hawkishness is right-wing, whatever. I don't find that very useful, but that's what they say. But I say that to kind of put on blast these NPR people who tend to think of themselves often, more than not, like, greatly disproportionate, right, to the population on the whole. Listeners of NPR would have a post, well, they would have a baccalaureate education or higher, maybe graduate, even postgraduate. A lot of people who think highly of their own educational accomplishments and cognitive abilities tend to listen to NPR if they don't know what the internet is. So if you don't know what the internet is, or, you know, how does the internet work? How do people get this? What is this, Twitter or whatever? Or if you want to feel like you're getting the truth and cutting through all the noise of social media, you go to NPR if you're a college-educated liberal in the American, you know, center-left definition of the word liberal. What they are reporting, and here's the big shit, they're reporting now that Ukrainians are returning back to Ukraine. Listen, Medica Poland is a quiet and idyllic farming village near the... Is this the fucking people from the LA Times writing for NPR now? What is this? Who are these? Ari Shapiro. Oh, not Ari fucking Shapiro. People who know Ari Shapiro, that's all things considered. He's a narcissist and a liar. There isn't a war that he doesn't love to pretend that he's against while loving. Now go on. Medica Poland is a quiet and idyllic farming village near the southeastern border with Ukraine. But in recent months, it has become... This is how journalism in the U.S. I know it's bizarre. Don't you just want to say, like, so-and-so announced, the mayor of Medica announced that the number of refugees has grown too high, da-da-da-da-da, we're looking at ways to mitigate the situation, quoted the so-and-so mayor of Medica to the such-and-such agency. That would be Russian news, right? The American news goes like this. Medica is a quiet and idyllic farming village, but in recent months, it has become the busiest border crossings for Ukrainian refugees since the war with Russia began in late February. In February and March, refugees waited for hours or days there to cross into Poland. Now, the flow has reversed. Well, that's why Poroshenko almost killed himself, because he was driving in the reverse lane. He was driving the opposing lane. He had his driver gun it across the border. They apprehended him. It was hilarious to see Poroshenko. He's trying to leave to Poland. They've been having him on Fox, on the news and stuff, former president, saying he supports Zelensky and stuff, and, you know, in the conflict, right? But in reality, Zelensky's prosecuting him for fraud, corruption. So he's not under arrest, but his passport has been frozen pending this investigation, which may lead to an arrest. of Poroshenko by Zelensky's prosecutors. Those things get very interesting. I know that Zelensky is not our favorite boy right now, but there's sometimes reality isn't like black or white or two-way fights. It's like three-way fights, four-way fights, five shit show. Okay, the shit show with Ukraine is that the Bidens and Zelensky aren't good with each other. Okay? Zelensky hates, you know, Poroshenko's people, right? And a Poroshenko prosecutor was replaced by a Zelensky appointee who went after the Bidens and the Burisma thing. Okay? I know it's like getting into the ancient history from the year 2020, but he tried to leave. So anyway, Poroshenko tries to leave in the middle of the night, and he has his driver, according to reports, pull into the oncoming lane and gun it. By the way, in this part of the world, that's normal. I drive into oncoming traffic all the time. I'm not kidding. All the time. That's normal in this part of the world. In Greece, Italy, the Balkans, and in a lot of the rest of outside of stop sign and yield sign Europe, like North and Western Europe, actually Northwestern Europe. Outside of Northwestern Europe, you drive, you make roads where you desire them, and you stop. You know, red lights are suggestions, important ones to follow at times if you see, you know, cars coming the other way. But Zelensky, Poroshenko, did I say Zelensky? Poroshenko was arrested. We don't know if he was released immediately. They probably bribed on the spot, but we don't know if he got out of the country, but we believe he did not. We believe he didn't. But people are waiting for hours to get from Poland back into Ukraine. Why is that? Well, number one, there probably was a limit on that people couldn't get out of Poland. That didn't give them access to Germany. It didn't give them access, you know, the money dried up. All of these programs, and we're with you forever, and we love Ukraine, that shit, like the Ukrainian flags are still hanging from the jamboree, the bandstand, and the welcome committee and everything. Those flags are still out, but, you know, they say guests, like fish, after 3 days begin to smell bad, and that's where you're at with it. And this was, people thought they were being cunning, and people thought they were taking advantage of a conflict. Now, realistically, with the Russian army two-thirds around the perimeter of Kiev, I can see how people from the capital and from, you know, really the central west of the country and further would think that more is about to pop off real, real big and we better get out now. So that was a real part of it. Those people, you know, that's a realistic thing. I would probably do similar. I'm not saying everyone who left thought they were going to get a German citizenship welfare ticket and, you know, free lunch. We're not saying that. But there has to be some of that drying up. Ukrainians are coming back to Ukraine. It's harder to get back into Ukraine by the length of the line than to leave Ukraine. So why are people lining up to get back into Ukraine? I'll tell you why. Because people know people, and people don't have to read news. People talk to their friends, and everywhere that people left that they were maybe worried, they see is fine now. And now that things have normalized, and we live in this situation where over the next couple of months, as I said, yes, Russia will pick up more and more of Nikolaev, of other oblasts. They'll probably take, Dnipro. They'll take lots of. It'll just happen. And now, and Ukrainians are returning to Ukraine and finding that the chances of them being hurt in this conflict are fairly low. And people are also seeing kind of like what happens after the Russians have a city. And they're like, okay, life has not substantively changed. It's just a different, a different clan of tax farmers is tax farming me now on the land that I live. And now it'll be Russia. And there will probably be the same types of local corruption, but less higher level corruption. Because Ukraine at the very, very top is corrupt. And the corruption runs all the way through. And every country has corruption. And Russia has corruption, the good kind. I can explain that later. I call it accessible or democratic corruption. In other words, if you can, hand a police officer $40 to get out of a situation that might cost you thousands and lose your license or something like that, that's good. That's democratic corruption. I like that. I like when you have local ways to get things done. We want to build here. We need to get a license. Let's take the guy out for lunch. Does he direct a nonprofit or a charity somewhere we can donate to? You see? I guess that's legal. But, can we put the money in his pocket and say, do this quid pro quo? And that's corruption, right? That's the difference, by the way. Stop talking about all the things that you're doing, by the way. Just do them. The more you talk about the things that you're doing, the more that you're like framing them for people and framing yourself, and you're kind of setting up a state of mind that people are going to see you. Just fuck everyone else. Just do your plan. Don't talk about what you're doing. Just do it. Anyway, so our idyllic farming town, waiting all night to get back. They talked to one girl. We're waiting all night here, and all of us are really tired. She says, this is Kobernik. Is a graduate, this is a girl, is a graduate from Kiev getting a master's in international relations. Over the last few months, this war has given her a crash course. It's my practical lesson. I'll get it. It's sad, of course, that actually the 21st century is not so fantastic that UN and many, many others, all of them can do nothing, Kobernik says. Anna Kobernik. Yeah? So they just explain the story of this town and how it used to be cars. It said they have a caption of this long line of cars. After almost 3 months since the war began, families are returning through the Poland-Ukraine border in Medyka. So it's a human interest story, as all stories are in Western news, in American news. Every story has to connect on a human level to dumb it down for the readers that you despise. To humanize it. Because readers can't understand, don't know when you say things are very hard for people. They don't know what that means. You have to quote someone saying, things are very hard for me. And then it's real, you see? You can't just say, it's been a long line. People are probably tired. They have to get someone, quote, it's been a long night. We're very tired. You see, we're up all night, end quote. That's how you manufacture truth. People are happy to be reunited, but some people died. Some people died and we'll never see them again, but now we're back. Destination cities include Kiev, Lviv, and Ivano-Frankivsk. It's a very strange feeling, says Anastasia Boriko. It's a very strange feeling because when we left, we were very scared. We were escaping. Why is it a strange feeling? Is it, are you saying that things are less dangerous now? Are you saying that things were not as dangerous as you thought? You see? These are narrative changes. That's big news. Ukrainians are returning to Ukraine. Now, if you wanted to make, you know, like a Frankenstein, if you want to, like, combine propaganda forces, like, take some Russian, like, do a little concoction, take some Russian propaganda and mix it with some American propaganda, we could make a nice little, you know, mixed drink here, get hammered together. We could say that Ukrainians are lining up to return to Ukraine as Russians begin to rebuild Mariupol. See? That's how you tie those together. As Russian efforts in rebuilding parts of Ukraine that they have liberated during the special military operation, millions of Ukrainians are now returning with renewed confidence in the objectives of the Russian special military operation, right? That's how you could, you know. God, these bio, like interviewing seven people. You know, I get that. Don't get me wrong. But anecdata is a real stupid fucking way to go about doing sociology and understanding where people are. So first you need the data. First you need the sociology, the real data, and the real data. Okay. Then when you interview people that, and you should find that they tend to, right, fit the sociology, right, then your anecdata is a meaningful and useful coloration of your sociologic data. But if you're using anecdata as a surrogate, a heuristic, or a shortcut, or even to misrepresent the sociology, that's what you run into too often with journalism that focuses on human interest and focusing on the plights of... Have you seen how many videos that I've shared of residents of Mariupol talking about how happy they are with the Russians rebuilding Mariupol? No, you haven't seen that many of them because I don't like those stories. Like, I want to see the statistics. I want to see employment. I want to see the number of buildings damaged. I want to see the number of buildings. I want receipts. I want to see the number that the Russians rebuilt. You know, I don't want to see Izvestia doing a photo op of one school out of 50 reopening. I want to see all the schools. You know, I want to see the data. Then when you interview people, when the Russians interview people about saying, oh, we're happy with what the Russians are doing, then it's meaningful. Then that anecdata is meaningful coloration of real existing sociologic data or real existing facts. Without that, I don't have no fucking interest. I find it dumb, actually. Maybe I need more estrogen. But I'm not touched. You see what I'm saying? And I'm an emotional guy and everything. I mean, you know, I'm in control of my emotions most of the time. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't pull at my heartstrings. I think I've just been involved in media and messaging for too long. I know how much preparation goes into talking to people, especially some of these people they talk to. There's all kinds of, how do people meet people? Where do you find them? How do you come across them? You know, how much work is a journalist really doing? Isn't it more reasonable that the journalist has been assigned contact with people that are part of a pro-Russian organization that already exists inside of Mariupol? They already have activists that are working on some things. And then you just talk to some of those people, but as their citizen-civilian side, not like their involvement in some, you know, probably fairly decent, good organization involved in cleaning up or bringing back the Russian character of certain parts of Eastern Ukraine. I totally get that, you know, but they're not going to tell you that these people that they're interviewing about the horrors of the situation are actually members of pro-Russian groups, okay? But that's okay too, you see. It's okay that people are. It's just useful to mention these things. I find it, you know. And maybe it's not useful for propaganda, but it's useful for the truth. And maybe I don't have any basis to say every person, but I think a third of them or half of them that you've seen interviewed on either side who say the things that you would expect them to say. Okay. Anyway, let's go global. Think about how they took a month and a half to come to terms that Mariupol had fallen just because of the standoff at Azovstal, which was not, you know, a place that people lived. The rest of the city was already being secured. The cleanup was already started. And media didn't admit that the situation had happened, that like that had, you know, that the event had happened until May 18. This is a thing we knew about in the first week of April. Chechens were running street-to-street cleanup operations through all of the rest of the neighborhoods. The center and most of the periphery of the city were, talking about 500,000 people, 450,000 people. 80,000, 50,000 Russians had been ethnically cleansed from Mariupol during the 8 years that it was controlled by Azov Battalion. Ethnically cleansed doesn't necessarily, and oftentimes does not mean murdered, but that conditions, social, legal, political, violence, conditions are such that people are feel better off leaving when they can, while they can, than staying to see what happens. Maybe having already seen some bad things happen to people they know. That's how ethnic cleansing works. It's soft pressure a lot of times. But these are specific policies. We saw Poroshenko. Our children will go to school. Their children will live in basements, afraid of being shelled. That those were his words. He said that. Far behind on reporting Mariupol. They are much more on top of Severodonetsk. They know how big Severodonetsk is, symbolically, and the fact that they are focusing on this is huge. It's not a big city like, you know, what, 1.5 million people like Kharkov. It's a fraction of that. You know, it's a tenth of that, right? It's not 400,000 or 500,000 people like Mariupol. Western news could have ignored this and just focused on other aspects of the conflict, but there's a problem. There are not other aspects right now of the conflict for them to positively cover. There's not developments that they would, you know, happy about. They mentioned developments were coming and they never materialized. They mentioned big pushes, counteroffensive, Zaporizhia, Kherson, those were supposed to be Kharkov, all those three oblasts were supposed to be big zones of these big pushes. And what ends up happening? They announce these big counteroffensives or whatever, and it's a little push, like 200, 300 guys go into a village. The 30 Russians whose job it was to hold the village decide to leave several hours before the Ukrainians come in. Okay, so they trade that. Ukraine has managed a few of those, but they're not catching headlines. Okay, now, and I'm not being selective, biased, I should say. I'm looking at the front page of CNN, the front page of MSNBC, the front page of BBC, the front page of NPR, the front page of Washington Post. What we've talked about here today is exactly what's across the front page of all of those. Okay? Zelensky's going to meet today, tomorrow, in a virtual, he's going to give a virtual whatever talk. This European conference on the conflict, I don't think they're going to come away with it with a changed approach. It's bad news today. They are, this is what it is. Meeting today and tomorrow, and the Ukrainian strategy is to use Severodonetsk to present it as a pending crisis from which they need help right now, okay? Even though you can see that the deep state, the cabal, is aware that that's kind of the bottom-up kind of grassroots, in a sense, like from the military Ukrainian bureaucracy, those are the real needs. Like, we need more weapons, guys. Like, we're not, you know, we're getting hit every day out here. We need better, longer range, bigger boom, more, all of it now. And money. Money now. The American thing captured headlines, and then it was like, okay, congratulations, here you go, fuck off. They're not getting that money yet. It's trickling. It's not like someone handed over. They didn't parachute in $30 billion. They didn't wire it. It's a menu. And a couple times a month, you get to open the menu and order more things from this overpriced menu. And you have 30 billion, you know, simoleons credit at a store that's marked up like 1,000%. So just take a zero off. That would be 3 billion. Yeah, I think I've read somewhere between 3 and 7 billion worth of actual stuff will wind up trying to get into Ukraine, okay? So just think about that. About 20% of that total money is going to be transformed into actual weapons that they will then try to get into the relevant parts of Ukraine without being destroyed. That's the game right now. They don't really believe it. They don't really believe it. We know they don't really believe it, that this is going to, you know, this is going to have a positive outcome in the conflict in the traditional sense. They have the big meetings today and tomorrow. Zelensky's going to present. I think he might mention Severodonetsk if he does, or he's going to allude to it in terms of, we have a big crisis right now, which we could stop today. That's how I see that developing. And I think that realistically, Severodonetsk is now mostly under Russian control. I think we have proof of that, photographic evidence of most of that now. But you can't, obviously, Western media has gone above and beyond, you know, the call of duty and even mentioning Severodonetsk. But what purpose would reporting on that serve? Number one, people at this point who are following the conflict, maybe still through Washington Post and New York Times, have higher level of buy-in to the outcome than people who were all wrapped up in the original, like, boom, boom headline, like when the thing first popped off in, you know, March and much of April was dominated. Everyone was, you know, subsumed in this, and we're going to have, you know, Zelensky at Cannes Film Festival. Sean Penn's going to self-emulate on the Austrian Parliament steps if Zelensky is not invited to the Oscars. Remember all that? Reality is setting in. People are moving back to Ukraine. The Russian control over Ukraine grows day by day, steadily, surely, incrementally. Nothing is stopping it. Nothing is stopping it. And Western audiences still following this conflict may begin to move on, yeah, to more thorough and robust and accurate and consistent sources of information if they're invested in the story, looking for it maybe slightly more alternative, and they might run into some truth along the way. So it's very important at this stage for New York Times, WAPO, NPR, to start introducing, now that the audience is more refined, yeah, it's a different demographic than the initial audience, because remember, we're 100 days into this conflict, right? So we're 3 months in, right? Over 3 months in. And people invested in this conflict want more information, or they want the information to be consistent with new information lines that they now feel are credible enough. So they'll go to NPR, or they'll, you know, go to BBC or listen, and then they'll compare that with what they're hearing from, you know, slightly alternative perspectives, right? And if the mainstream legacy media is going to deal with this audience in the same way that they dealt with the audience from 100 days ago, they're going to hemorrhage that very refined audience. It's not going to be credible. They can't, what am I saying? They can't not mention Severodonetsk. They're just not going to have, there's no point in continuing to cover Ukraine if you're not going to cover Severodonetsk for your audience, which is already starting to listen to me. I think I picked up one. Yeah? That's right. So, welcome, by the way, Anthony, from no longer reading Washington Post. We have shift happening. See what I did? I took a sociologic fact and then I named it Anthony. And now you're like, oh, there's a real guy. You know, he's had a very hard time. Well, he's 26. He's an engineering student from Kyiv. I think they just make up these people for these reports. I think they take a photograph of a random person, and then they just, here, sign this waiver. Yeah, that's how it's done. Anyway, I think that's our show for today. Media is losing it. The cope is big. It's hard. It's Copacabana. Don't fall in love. All right, I'm out.